Good day and welcome to Letters and Politics. I'm Mitch Jezerich, and I am very happy to welcome back to this radio station Max Dashue. 50 years ago, Max Dashue began the Suppressed Histories Archives project that documents women in history throughout time. That is what we're going to be in conversation about today. Max Dashue is the author of the book Witches and Pagans, Women in European Folk Religion, 700 to 1100 AD. You can also find her work online at suppressedhistories.net. Max Dashue, good to see you again. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Mitch.
And I want to congratulate you because you are celebrating the 50th anniversary now of the Suppressed Histories Archives.
That's it. This winter was 50 years. Perseverance does further.
Talk to me about how you first started doing this in 1970. How you started, you know, I guess for lack of a better word, excavating the stories of women in history.
Yeah. Well, that was a hard assignment at the start. My initial starting point was, where in the world are women free? Or where have women been free? You know, what is there some other kind of cultural record than the one we've all been handed with great male philosophers, leaders, scientists, great minds, man the artist, all these things that basically just, you know, carpet our whole education, you know? And so you've got these exceptional women who are usually royals, you know, that may come in here and there. But I wanted to see both to find women who were public leaders, but also to see in a more social way, you know, entire communities of women who may not be named, but who were originators, culture creators, public authorities. So that takes you like into the medicine women, the seers, the female oracles, the Oracle of Delphi being a known example because that's, you know, in the Greek world. So we get taught a little bit about that. But really looking at cultural patterns more also and seeing what women's standing was like in different kinds of societies and how that was transformed, the historical process that developed patriarchal systems and then the relationship of those to other systems of domination. So enslavement, conquest, colonization, racialized caste systems, class systems, all of those are implicated. They're all systems of domination. But over time, you know, I was looking for my anthropology professor in 1969 was saying, well, there are matrilineal societies, but it doesn't mean anything. And I'm just, okay, I got to find out more about this. And so
it
doesn't mean anything because men have always been dominant. So even in matrilineal societies, men still rule. That was his position, you know.
When we say matrilineal, which we mean is that the family stays within the woman.
Right.
The
mother. In other words, each person's social identity comes through the mother.
Yeah.
So their access to name, to their relatives, their land, any kind of their collective belonging comes through the mother. And so patriarchy is predicated on enforcing descent in the male line. And in order to do that, you have to control women's movements, bodies, sexuality. It's a colonization of women's bodies, essentially. Okay? And that's one reason why we see an interrelationship of patriarchy and class systems, any kind of system of ranking and domination. But with class systems, there's this relationship of accumulation of property. And how is the property going to be passed on? And so this is where we start to get these really savage enforcements of the sexual double standard on women, including being buried alive, stoned, all these female punishments that arose in order to keep women within the lines of a patriarchal system.
Max Dashue, talk to me about the history of slavery. And obviously when we talk about slavery, we think about the transatlantic slave trade, and with good reason, because it's so important in our own history and the effects that we still experience today. But as a practice, slavery goes back thousands of years, and it wasn't always based just on the color of a skin. So talk to me about the history of slavery and women.
Well, if you look at early societies, you do not see standing armies. You do not see a militarized culture. The weapons they had were, a lot of them were basically hunting weapons. Maces come into being. In the Bronze Age and the Iron Age, you start to see swords and other kinds of, you know. But it's not a militarized society. But there were raids that went on, and there were these low-level combats, not on the level of national invasion, usually, but this other thing. And so this pattern of taking captives was happening. And so it was easier to enslave women than men who were trained to war. And so they would slaughter the men and they would take the women captive, which is a horrible fate.
What time period?
Well, it depends where you are in the world.
Yeah.
Okay, so if we're talking about the end of the Neolithic in Europe, you know, and the beginning of the Bronze Age, you're seeing a lot of that going on. Yeah. They still don't really have what we could call empires in a modern sense, but there's a lot of these chiefly societies and big men who are accumulating wealth and leadership to themselves. And a lot of the price of their prestige and standing is other people who are being enslaved or otherwise exploited, right? Warfare as a way of accumulating wealth. And see, one of the things in those societies is that you get power by having a lot of men of war, you know, a lot of warriors. And so the clans could expand themselves through polygyny. So the big men could take a lot of wives, and then they would have more sons. They would increase the numbers of their whole community, and thereby their military strength. And that included enslaved women who had no choice about being forced to have sex and bear children by their captors, you know, rape, essentially. So that pattern was something that existed in the early period, and we can't really document it very well, but we can see the differentiation of wealth. We see the growth of warfare. There's evidence of this thing's going on. You know, this is something that's very difficult to track in the historical record. There's just pieces of
that. That was going to be my question. Are the stories, if we're looking at antiquity, perhaps the Mediterranean world, are the stories of women slaves lost?
Well, to a large degree, we have bits and pieces, and sometimes those are linguistic. Like, for example, we can track through Indo-European linguistics bondmaids at the mill. There's this theme. So the Irish word for an enslaved woman was cumal or cumal, and it meant the woman at the grindstone. And there are legends also that the Norse have about giantesses who are made to labor at the grindstone. And in that story, this is more of a myth, they are these profound earthen powers. They're these beings of tremendous, they're divine beings, essentially, who have all this strength. And so they're forced to labor at the millstone, but because the king is making them grind out gold, because they're giantesses, he works them mercilessly. And so they rebel, and they begin grinding harder and harder, and then the grindstone is broken and overturned. And then they say, ground have we, Frothi, we are done at laboring at the mill. And so this is like the end of his regime. So that's a mythologization. But this idea of bondmaids, and you'll find that throughout medieval European history, different names given to them in Denmark, you know, in the remnants of the old Roman Empire. Sometimes the names for these enslaved people are actually ethnic names. So the word Welsh at one time meant an enslaved person, because the Anglo-Saxon conquerors of Britain enslaved a lot of the Britons. And the most famous example of this is slave itself.
Yeah.
Comes from the word Slav.
Yeah.
Right? And that not only entered the European languages, but it also entered Arabic. Sakaliba is from that same European root.
Talk to me more about the importance of folklore and language. And is this what we're getting at the heart of suppressed histories, that the history of women were suppressed? So this is where you actually find them in folklore or in language, and then I would anticipate then that presents some really great opportunities, but then challenges as well, right? At least in the traditional educational or scholarly world, where that you want, you know, hard facts,
right? But you know, okay, so history has changed a lot because it's become a lot more interdisciplinary. So there's that part. You know, when we're looking in the mythic and the linguistic record, we're not looking at actual people, like individual people. We're looking at storytelling that reveals patterns, you know, and ways that happened, and social patterns of, you know, what the standing of the enslaved people was like, and stories about that. You know, so they are they're statements more than they are exact, you know, this was this person and this happened to them, you know, like the bond maids at the Grinding Stone.
Yeah.
Behind that, we can actually visually see a whole groups of women who were taken captive in war, who were in servitude to the lordly families. You know, there's a lot of directions we could go with that, too, because it's not only the men, but also the women of those families. The women are divided by patriarchy, you know, by class, by ethnicity. And so, you know, it gives us a picture of the kind of labor they're meant that they're being doing, and also sometimes hints at the sexual colonization of the bond maid, which long precedes what happened to African-American women in the Americas, or Native women, too, who were enslaved in the early times. So that we see that once you're in the hand, as one of the famous old Roman phrases, you know, actually not only Roman, Muslim too, you know, those who your right hands possessed, meaning those who are taken captive in war. And so Muhammad is saying, you know, that it is lawful to you to have sex with the women who your right hands possess, you know, so this is really bad for enslaved women.
That's what enslavement meant.
Yeah, that's what it meant. It meant automatic domination over your body, and it wasn't necessarily only females who were subjected to that, because males could be raped too, and were. But, you know, women are the archetypical form, you know, and the traffic in women. If we go back to the Greco-Roman period, we're seeing, first of all, captives. And these are not only captives from Scythia or other foreign places that Greeks were warring with, but also within Greece itself, there were wars where people, you know, an army would descend from over here and take captive the people from this city and sell them off into slavery. And this was going on in classical times. And that's really important because there is this notion of foreignness, but it doesn't necessarily parse out the way that we think of in the racialized scheme that we've inherited from the American caste system. We're seeing with the Greeks, you know, they're outsiders. They may also be Greeks, but of course they're seen more as outsiders if they're from Asia, you know. But that's a big pattern. And so these enslaved women, a lot of them were sold into brothels. You know, brothels were slave institutions through Greco-Roman civilization, the bulk of it, you know. And a man could buy a personal slave, and when he tired her of her, he could rent her out to his friends, or he could just pawn her off on a brothel. And the other ways that those brothels or slavery was filled, the ranks of the enslaved grew, not only by enslaved women giving birth, but also free women who were having daughters. The father had in Greece and Rome as well the sole power to expose any children he didn't want. And these were daughters. You have records, they've done statistical analysis of Greek families, and you see the paucity of female children. You know, they want sons. And so they would often expose those girls, and what happened to them? They didn't all die. There were predatory people who would rescue the girl, so that was a good thing. But then they would raise her to sell into slavery or to enslave themselves, you know. And so that's another channel within the society itself for servitude.
This is Letters and Politics, and we are in conversation with Max Dashu, who 50 years ago began the Suppressed Histories Archives. She is the author of the book, Witches and Pagans, Women in European Folk Religion, 700 to 1100. And this Saturday in Richmond, for our listeners in the San Francisco Bay Area, you're going to be celebrating 50 years of the Suppressed Histories Archives. And it's an event on Saturday night, which is February 28th, 29th, appropriate, I guess, for it to be on the 29th,
it's
right?
It's a bleep year day.
It's
where the unusual comes through. It's a portal for that which has not been allowed.
It's going to be 7 to 9:30 p.m. in Richmond at the, what is it, the Cobiz?
Cobiz.
And that's at 1503 McDonald Avenue in Richmond, the Cobiz, Saturday, February 29th, 7 to 9:30. You do need tickets to be able to attend the event. Can you get tickets there, or do you have to get
them? Well,
if
we don't sell out, there will be tickets there. And okay. I want to mention that
if you don't sell out, though, that's probably important.
Yeah.
It could sell out.
Yeah, could sell out. I don't know. It's right on top of the Richmond BART, so it's easy to get to.
Okay.
It's like literally a block from the BART.
Okay. Well, that's easy. Yeah. So again, at the Cobiz, 1503 McDonald Avenue, Richmond, this Saturday, 7 to 9:30 p.m., accessible via BART, and your event's wheelchair accessible as well.
Yes. Yeah, and I just want to mention that I'm going to be sharing like the sum total. It's like sort of really just the whole range of subjects and treasures that I've found, like some of the best of, you know, the cream of the crop in a way, just as a way to taste the vast range of human history that we're not aware of because we live in this very mediatized society that it has its own storytelling, but it's completely shaped by a capitalist ethos, you know, and it's very ethnocentric and it's very patriarchal. So to see images of women as healers or oracles or political leaders. I have a show called Rebel Shamans, Women Confront Empire. We see women as military leaders, as resistors against empire. There's a whole range of topics. So we're going to be looking at all of that.
And we'll give the event, we'll give the details of the event as we move along this show. So we'll bring these events, we'll talk about the event furthermore as we move along. Are there, you know, and I think I want to go back to slavery in the ancient world. You know, there's a few male slaves that we certainly know of. I mean, just at the top of my head, I think of Spartacus. Mm-hmm. Are there female slaves
famous
from the ancient
ones?
World that you have been able to identify?
Well, I have. I mean, the next book that I'm coming out with is going to be about the Hellenic world. And so there are pieces, they're really shreds about these women. There's one woman that's mentioned in a speech by Demosthenes. And the speech is called...
The great orator,
yes,
right?
The speech is called Against Neaera. And this woman is an enslaved woman of foreign origin. And, you know, I should have read up about this before I came. I have a whole chapter about it. But basically, there's this denunciation of her as a sorceress. The way that you could get people like that. I think she actually did. She was a freed woman. She had actually bought her freedom. And that's kind of you don't ever get totally free under these Greco-Roman systems. You still have a patron. You still have to obey them. And, you know, it's not free and clear by any means. But anyway, it's one of the very interesting witch trials that happens in ancient Greece. And this is not something we normally think of when we're told about Greek civilization. And that's partly because the information is packed over into the corners. And so there's a little bit here and a little bit there. And so this one speech of
Demosthenes. And that's what you're always having to do, right? You're always having to, like, put these little pieces.
These little shreds
and then try
to flesh them out. Yeah. And sometimes there's more to be found, you know. And so, you know, it gives us a view, though, that there's this whole cultural world, the underside of the iceberg. You know, the tip is over the historical waterline. Yeah. And then underneath that are these communities of women who are either enslaved or they're foreigners, they're metics, you know, so they are not full citizens. Of course, we know women are full citizens in ancient Greece. And they have their own ceremonies. You know, they're carrying out rituals that are regarded as threatening by the master class, by the male citizens of Greece, because there's power in it. And so this charge of witchcraft arises. And we see this also in the Roman world. In 180 BCE, there's a huge repression that smacks down against the common people and, again, a lot of foreigners. There's all this cultural exchange going on between Egyptians and Syrians and Romans and Celts and Germanics, people, whoever was, you know, living on the Aventine
multi-ethnic
Hill.
Multi-ethnic empire.
Very much so. Yeah. And there was a lot of cultural sharing going on, and they were doing ceremonies. They were doing ecstatic ceremonies together. And so... Livy is the main source for this repression. He says that 7,000 people were executed, you know, and there was this fear of the power because these were primarily female groups.
Early witch hunt?
Yeah. 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 I have a whole chapter about this in another of my volumes on the imperial world of Rome. But anyway, what's really interesting about these accusations is you see some of the same target groups that we see now. Women, gays or queers or trans people, you know, they're talking about these vicious men who are, you know, they're simultaneously supposed to be gay and also rapists, you know, bad models for boys. You've got the enslaved people, and they're participating in these ceremonies, which Rome really cracked down very heavily on foreign religions. At a certain point, they threw up their hands and they gave in. But they were destroying temples of Isis that grew up, and there was this fear of the power, the spiritual power of movements that were not controlled from the top down.
Forgive me, I think I got us off topic concerning what Demosthenes said. And just for context, Demosthenes, again, was considered, you know, this, you know, important orator. I think he was warning, you'll correct me if I'm wrong, of the coming of Philip of Macedon and then Alexander the Great and the destruction of the
I think the
Greek
Persians.
Democracy.
Maybe the Persians.
Uh-huh. But what did he say? But you were telling the story about Demosthenes.
Yeah, well, so he has this speech against Neaera. And so this previously enslaved woman of foreign origin is held up as the demonic figure that's a threat to the entire society. And he's referring in passing to the fact that she's tried as a witch. And this is another aspect of slavery. And this is something most people don't know, both Greeks and Romans. It was not only legal to torture enslaved people in trials, it was mandatory. You know, a person who was a slave owner had the right to prevent the enslaved person from testifying against them, but he could force them to testify against others. And so it was the belief was that the slave would lie, and so they had to be tortured as if that was somehow going to really give you the truth, which is, you know, an error that continues with the Inquisition. It's just really, it's dominance thinking gone amok, you know. And so this is part of the picture of what these witch trials looked like, and we just have little pieces about them. So this is the very tip of a whole iceberg of what was really happening to these enslaved women inside Athens in particular. This is what we know the most about. The rest of Greece is, to a large extent, terra incognita, and that's surprising to a lot of people, but that's where most of the historical record is.
Tell me about what you call rebel shamans.
So this is a pattern I noticed. When I was making my first DVD, Women's Power and Global Perspective, I had a lot of women who had led revolts against empire or colonization. And most of them were indigenous women. The great bulk of them were native women, whether they were in Africa, the Americas, the Philippines. And so at first I just had a little handful, but I started a visual talk about them. So they are medicine women. They're diviners. They are prophetesses. They are women who are seen as having spiritual power within whatever the context is of those societies. And if you're in many parts of Africa, they do have this sphere of power for women as a prophetic seer, for example, or as a priestess, as a leader of ceremony. And so that in turn becomes a really crucial point of leadership when the society is under assault by colonial armies who are bringing in weapons that have never been seen before. And this is really dire struggle to keep their countries, to, you know, stop this genocide in many cases. It takes something more than the normal military organization. It takes also some kind of spiritual charisma to mobilize people. Spiritual power, you know, the deities of that society, the ancestors, whatever it is they're calling on. And so you have, so many examples, the rain shrine priestesses in Senegal. You have in Native America, the two-spirit woman, Lozin, who is a seer and really basically single-handedly protects this Chiricahua Apache from both the U.S. and the Mexican armies. They're running back and forth across the border trying to flee from these armies. And in California, there's numerous examples. A woman named Toypurina of the Quiche Nation, sometimes they call them there's another name I can't think of at the moment, but down in the Los Angeles Mission, this is in the 1700s. Late 1700s. And so she spearheads a revolt, and they are going to rise up and overthrow the mission friars who are enslaving them, along with the soldiers, of course. But the revolt is caught before it gets off the ground. And so that one was thwarted. About 40 years later, in the Chumash country around Santa Barbara, there was a woman, again, whose name we don't know. I just call her the prophetess of Shapu because she is like an oracle for the Mother Earth and saying, you know, they're enslaving us. We have to get out of here. We have to wash off the baptism with the tears of the sun, and we need to recover our freedom. And so they organize over a period of like a decade at least with these prophecies by this woman. And they rise up against the mission and they succeed partway. Half of them get free and flee to the interior, and the other half are either killed or re-enslaved in the missions.
Santa Barbara.
Yeah.
We don't know her name, but how do we know of her story? How do you know of her story?
There was a book, Ism Press has a book that somebody named Fogel wrote about the history of California. And so he had the original source materials. I can't think off the top of my head what they were. But, you know, these are written accounts from the Spanish colonials. That's eventually what letters to the viceroy or whoever it may be, you know. And that's really our sources most of the time. The written record comes from the ruling class.
Who is being a thorn in their side.
Yeah. Well, and here's the interesting thing about it, because these patterns of colonization that were laid in Europe are later then against European peoples, against tribal European peoples, are then turned against native peoples in the European conquest. So penitential books that were used to try and stamp out paganism in the early Middle Ages by the priesthood are still being used by the Spanish mission priests against the Chumash. And so they would write up a list of all the different kinds of ceremonies or the things they had observed and saying, if you see people doing this, this is diabolic and you must stamp it out. And they would interrogate people. Do you know anybody that does these kinds of ceremonies? You know, so this was cultural warfare. You know, the conquest is not only the military subjection, it's the process of colonizing the mind and the culture, stamping out the language, destroying the religion, which is a glue, you know. It's the basis of unity for any society, that language and the spiritual philosophies. So there's many examples in the Philippines. Even Joan of Arc falls into this pattern.
I was going to ask about Joan of Arc.
I have her in the show.
The 15th century?
Yeah. Yeah, in the early 1400s. And so
France is occupied by England?
Exactly. The Hundred Years' War comes to an end with her. You know, France has been occupied. They're groaning under the English yoke. And it was like, how is it that a peasant woman, who was the last person you would ever see as a leader of aristocratic armies of that time, and yet somehow with this charisma that she had, in her
the voices
of St. Michael and St. Catherine told her what to do. And so she becomes this charismatic leader who actually mobilizes the French resistance, as the knights never could, and succeeds in overthrowing the English rule. And then the way the English get her, because she's a hero to the people, she's just lauded, she's adored, is they turn her over to the Inquisition, and they accuse her of being a witch and an idolater.
Yeah. And
then
execute her.
Ultimately, she's executed not on those charges, but because she refuses to put on female clothing. And there's a rape story behind this.
Interesting.
You know, she wore male clothing as a female amongst all male armies. You really can't go around. I mean, you have to wear male dress. And she did that. But even people don't know that with Joan d'Arc, she was actually forced to undergo a virginity test, because if she wasn't a virgin, then she could be a witch. And there was this suspicion of witchcraft that hovered around her because she did have this power at the very beginning of her career, as well as the way that it ended at the stake.
I mean, she died young.
Yeah, very young. She was only, I think, 17 when she started, and it was only a couple years.
Yeah, I think it was like right around 19 or so. I mean, I could be off a little bit on that.
By the time she died, maybe.
Yeah. excuse me. Are there other such shaman rebels we could talk about? And as I'm just thinking off the top of my head, I could think of two historically important female sort of rebel leaders. I guess that's what, I don't know if that'd be appropriate to say, but I think of Queen Boudica in England.
Who also had ceremony as part of her resistance. Sure, yeah. I mean, she was doing divinations, you know, and she was calling on the goddess Andraste. So there was a ceremonial component to her revolt. And around the same time in what's now the Netherlands, in the delta of the Rhine, along the Lippe River, there was a woman named Weleda. Well, she wasn't really named Weleda. This was a title that she had, and it means seeress. And she was a leader of the Bructerians. So these are the Celtic and Germanic tribes. She, along with a male co-leader, spearheads a revolt of these tribal Europeans against the Roman Empire. And she managed to unify all of these communities, and they actually put the Romans to flight for a while. But of course, there was more where those troops came from. And as one Celtic leader said, it is by the blood of the provinces that the provinces are conquered, because these legionaries came from all the colonized nations, very much like our military does now. And so the revolt is eventually overthrown. But, you know, the impetus for it is this spiritual leadership. And we can see this also in Guatemala. There's another example under the Spanish rule in the early 1712, I think, in Chiapas, actually, not Guatemala, but it was Maya country.
Yeah.
Maria Candelaria was a Tzeltal woman, and she had a shrine. They'd been nominally Christianized for a very short period of time, but a shrine to the Virgin Mary. And underneath that, of course, was the older Maya goddess. And so a Spanish priest destroyed it, and a Maya revolt materialized under the leadership of Maria Candelaria. And so they fought for, you know, most of a year. And, you know, they're fighting cannon, they're fighting muskets. They have farm tools, you know, so this is really an uneven battle. But the victory was, although that they lost their war, that she was never found. The people didn't give her up. She just faded back up into the hills, and the Spanish never captured her, although they offered rewards and, you know, they tortured people, but she didn't catch her.
Maria Candelaria.
Yeah, which, you know, the Catholic name, right? The
known
Feast
today,
of the Lights.
Still known today?
Yeah.
Important figure today?
Oh, it's, she's still known. There was a play about her that was written about 100 years ago. And, you know, there are various sources about her. And then later, Yucatan is another place with the Maya that you have a woman named Agustina Gomez Chechib. And she was a leading prophetic figure in the War of the Castas, the caste wars. Because these, what the Europeans do when they colonize the Americas is they drive the indigenous people down into an enslaved caste. Basically a feudal system. The old latifundia system of the Romans is carried over into the colonies of the Americas. And so the Maya rose up against this. This was a very serious political resistance in the mid-1800s. And so Agustina was one of the figures, and there's another very shadowy woman, again anonymous, who was a prophetess in the cave temple of Xucaneb in Yucatan. Sometimes we only get a little fragment like that, just a shard about these figures. You know, there's another group of stories out of Peru where you have Quechua women who were priestesses and medicine women, healers, visionaries in the 1600s. So there again, the Spanish have been ruling for at least 150 years in Peru. And these women would give heart to the men who are being marched off to die in the silver mines. You know, they would come to the road with food and drink. They would give them encouraging words. They were standing up to the local village priest or the village mayor, who was either Spanish or appointed by the Spanish. And so they underwent a series of inquisitorial witch trials in the 1600s. You know, there's a lot of this also going on in Brazil, and the Afro-Brazilians especially being targeted by the Portuguese Inquisition as witches, because they were leading candomblé ceremonies. So this Afro-Brazilian syncretistic religion, Catholicism mixed with Yoruba or Congo or other African ways, all those African cultural bases are the foundation for resistance on this spiritual level. Voodoo, another example, priestesses of Cécile Fatima, who inaugurated the great revolt of the Haitian Revolution against slavery.
Hmm.
In the Bois Caiman, she holds a voodoo ceremony, and she's got her Petro staff, and she's calling on, you know, Ezili Dantor, one of the Petro Loa, to protect and help the rebel Haitians in their fight against the French slavers.
Mags, I feel like we need a book,
yeah,
on women rebel leaders. I mean, I'm thinking of another one. One last one. Her name escapes me, but she's African. Again, the Roman Empire, against the Roman Empire. And there was success. She was very successful.
You're thinking of the Kandaki, Amani Tore, I think was her name, in Sudan. She actually defeated the Roman legions.
Yeah.
She lost an eye in battle.
Yeah.
This was in the first century. Yeah. But there's a very interesting archaeological find around this, because this queen, so she remained in power. Augustus was forced out. But the Romans had come in there and they had put statues of their emperor around. And they found archaeologically the head of one of these Augustuses placed under the throne, under the feet of the statue of the Nubian ruler, of the Meroitic ruler. So that was a success story.
Max Dashew is our guest. Max Dashew is the founder of the Suppressed Histories Archives, which this year is celebrating 50 years in existence. In fact, this Saturday, February 29th, in Richmond, Max Dashew is going to have an event that's going to be in Richmond at the Cobiz, which is 1503 McDonald Avenue in Richmond, which is right next to Richmond BART station. You do need tickets to get in. Max, you said that if tickets are not sold out, then you can get them there, but there is a chance it could be sold out.
Right. I can't guarantee tickets if they've sold out, but who knows?
Excuse me. I still have this cough. And people can also get tickets online?
Yes. What you should do is go on Eventbrite and search for Suppressed Histories, and then it'll come right up.
Okay. To Eventbrite and search for Suppressed Histories. We'll give these details again. Let's talk about words a little bit. One thing I've enjoyed doing with you before is sort of the meanings be behind words. In fact, we just did a show with Peter Linebaugh on the Luddites. You know,
I heard it. And, yeah.
You know, that was kind of fun because we use it such as a pejorative, right, of people and technology where there's much deeper story to it. And I wanted to ask you about the roots of the word colonialism.
Yeah. Yeah, so coloni is a Latin word that originally referred to farmers who gradually fell into a serf-like state. What happened in the late Roman Empire is more and more land came out of the control of peasantry. They weren't freeholders anymore. They were now on the estates of these great landholders. So they were essentially serfs. So this is colone. They are there's a lot of argument about how much that term equates. Servi was the word for serf. That's where our word serf comes from, is from servi, servi in Latin. And so there's kind
is
of
that related to service?
Yeah, service, servitude, all those words, and serf. And the linguistic webs here are very interesting to look at, because from colonia, so a serfdom type of situation, which shades into slavery essentially in some ways and vice versa, later on becomes the base for colonialism, you know. And when you look at what was done in the Americas, you know, what are we talking about? Land seizure, especially in Latin America, which more kept to the Roman pattern, you have the pushing of the free native peoples down into peonage. They were serfs, essentially, by another name, peones. So they were enslaved as well. There was a slave trade in native people, too. Nicaragua and Yucatan were some areas that were very heavily raided that way. But the North America was not spared either from this. And you have the Goose Creek men. I'm getting off topic, I know. Okay, so back to coloni. And so in the early Middle Ages, this name persists. And then you also have servi becomes serf. And so the idea, both for coloni and serf, is someone who is tied to the land. They're not free to leave. They are in servitude on that land, and somebody else controls that land. And they're giving over a large share of their harvest, as well as other kinds of labor, to the patron. You know, and there's a lot of weird linguistic stuff that happens around this. Like one word in Latin would be clientes. So they are the clientes of the patron. Okay, and even the word patron, we've got a very patriarchal pattern going on here. You know, the great father is the literal meaning of that in Latin.
A patron.
Yeah. And so
cliente, is it client?
Yeah, client. And so, you know, client is one of the words that's used in Latin, but what's very irritating, and even in Moses Finley, whose writings I admire, there's this tendency to use the word dependence to refer to people who are in servitude. Now, when you think about the actual hardcore reality, it's that these people are feeding the parasitical classes above them. You know, they are the ones who are producing the grain, the milk, the meat. You know, it's their labor that is holding everything up. But they're called dependents. This annoys me. the class implications of it are just, it's an ideological intervention in the way that we think about it, as if somehow something was being given to them rather than taken from them. So that's my peeve about that word. But so colonizing, you know, I think that there's a dimension of colonizing that on top of the material aspect of it, where you're actually expropriating land, labor, goods, and even the bodies of the colonized, you know, through rape notably. I mean, this is certainly a pattern of North American colonization. The rape of Native women is pandemic. It's integral to that. And we're still seeing that now with the missing and murdered Indigenous women. There's no enforcement. It's complete impunity.
Yeah.
Right?
Big problem
for that.
Today.
So colonizing the body is also a metaphor in my mind for patriarchy. You know, the way that the female body is colonized for sex, for reproductive power, for labor, unpaid labor. And then ultimately, the colonization also becomes mental. And the role of culture and especially religion in this is very profound, because initially, this is done only through force. But over long periods of time, as these domination systems get naturalized and embedded so deeply that they're unconscious, then you have controls, internal controls, that are inculcated into women's minds that they owe allegiance in almost a feudal kind of way, obedience to the husband. This is written into the marriage ceremony. They are someone who is colonized, their body. I'll never forget Sonia Johnson came out of Mormonism, and she talks about how when her mother was giving her a bath and she was washing her genitals, she was saying, "Now this part of your body belongs to your future husband,
And
you should never touch it. It's his." You know, so that's a mental colonization. It's like an emotional colonization, you know, that and that goes in the antithesis of that is the entitlement of a Harvey Weinstein or any other number of other masterly figures, the masters of the universe, who think that they just have a right to any woman's body. You know, so that's a kind of a colonization.
How do we get from coloni to colonization? And is the coloni the people? I mean, could we consider the coloni to be the people that are the subjects under colonialism?
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, as I see it, it's just like they made a verb out of it. So colone is the noun, and that's the starting point as far as I know. And then colonize is to make a colone out of someone.
That's what you're doing. That's what
a colonizing cologne, to make a cologne.
A cologne.
Yeah.
That's what colonization is making colognes out of people. Who
right.
It's there.
It's the verbal process of doing that. So, you know, this is a later coinage. I don't know that term was used in Latin. We bear investigation, you know, of where that usage came about. But it was certainly by the period of, you know, the American colonizations.
Is that where we get sort of our modern term of colonization?
Yeah. I just want to look here for a second. Let's just think. So there's some other names that you know, you have all these synonyms for coloni in the late Roman and early medieval world. So they're called humiliores, the humble ones. So there's a polarity. There's the humiliores, and then there's the honestiores, the honest men. So that had a class dimension to it. You see it in medieval Europe still. You know, someone accused of witchcraft is protesting, but I'm an honest woman, meaning I'm decent, I'm respectable. You know, so there's this whole respectability ranking thing going on. But they're also called rusticani. So this is rural people, you know, people living on the land. You know, and this is what, in the context of the enclosures you were talking about the other day, The common people are cut from the land. As serfs, they're bound to the land. And then when capitalism comes in, the use of cash crops, whether it's wool or cotton or tobacco or whatever is being sold, pushes them off the land. You know, their labor is not needed, and now they're being forced into the factories. And this is where the Luddites come in, is that, you know, mechanization was a threat because the livelihood is just going to go. Rusticani, and then willis or willissima, the word vile, right? So really disrespectful word for the people at the bottom. They're nothing. lites, I don't even know what that means, or servi manuales, serfs in the hand, or slaves in the hand. So there's actually a whole group of names, you know, in this cusp between the Roman Empire and then its successors. You know, so many of the medieval European lords saw themselves as directly following in the footsteps of Rome.
Max Dashew, as we move to wrap up here, and this won't be the last time we do this, I certainly hope not. These historical dynamics that we have been talking about, whether it be colonialism or we haven't really got to it, but we will one day, the persecution kind of culture, or if we even just get to the systems of domination, how do those appear today? How do those things that we're talking about in the past manifest themselves today? Do you see direct connections?
Well, yeah. I mean, in a lot of ways. I mean, just following the colony analogy, it's like the American farmers are being driven off the land. It's, again, consolidating into great landholders, corporate farming now. It's much more mechanized. But there's a parallel there to what the Latifundia class was doing in Rome. The use of persecution, the use of military force, which we're seeing playing out with the Wet'suwet'en
in Canada,
you know, the great powers in our world, it's like I tend to refer to what we have now as corporate feudalism, you know, or even techno-feudalism. But, you know, there is this consolidation of power in these very wealthy owning classes, and everyone else, it's just like, you know, where do you fall in that? I mean, the ability to hold land, the ability to earn a living is, again, the control is being concentrated into systems that we don't really have an ability. Well, let's see how we do with this election, if we can overthrow this move to fascism. But there's a lot of parallels. The persecutory patterns that we didn't get to talk about so much. I mean, we're just talking about straight-up oppression today. But the persecutory patterns are really important because of the way that scapegoats are raised up as an object of hate and getting people who are fearful of opposing the lordship of their oppressors. It's dangerous to fight these very, very powerful oligarchs. They will slap you down, and people know that. It's easier to pick out someone as a target, whether that would be immigrants, Muslims, gays, women. You know, you could go on naming the people who are currently targets, you know, in these persecutory frenzies where people wind up being manipulated into rage rather than into joining together to stop this system of domination. You know, so I see that what has all that's preceded what we came to now is very much implicate. It's still embedded in the culture itself. And it's really shocking to see how quickly these old poisons can be resurrected when you look at the way that George Bush invoked the Crusades in order to invade Iraq. You know, it comes to mind very easily the way that old pogrom repression of the Jews was, you know, including the use of fire, you know, the burning, the ovens of Auschwitz had a predecessor of the Jew roasters in Germany and the quemadero in the Spanish Inquisition, whose main victims were Jews. And so there's a way that these toxins, if we don't uncover them and show what the story is and show how unjust they are, people tend to fall for it. They tend to fall for the manipulation, and this is the great danger that we're in now.
Max Dashew, thank you. Again, Max Dashew has been our guest. Max Dashew is the founder of the Suppressed Histories Archives, also author of the book Witches and Pagans, Women in European Folk Religion, 700 to 1100. Find her work online at suppressedhistories.net. And for our listeners in the San Francisco Bay Area, Max Dashew is going to be having a celebration this Saturday, which is February 29th, from 7 to 9:30 p.m. in Richmond at the Cobiz, which is at 1503 McDonald Avenue in Richmond, very close to Richmond BART station. You do need tickets for this event, and if you want to go online, just go to Eventbrite. And at Eventbrite, you could just look for Suppressed Histories to find tickets for this. And you're going to be giving a talk?
Yeah, I'm going to show images. I'm going to be sharing some of the best images, the most exciting and inspiring images. We could use a little bit of nectar right now to boost our spirits through all of this.
All right. So again, this is Saturday, February 29th, 7 to 9:30 p.m. at the Cobiz in Richmond, right next to Richmond BART.